I've had businesses stolen from me. I had a $10 million government contract stolen from me by Blackwater. And they were, you know, there were some challenges with those experiences, but I quickly saw that they were really important to happen because I was going down the wrong path.
What's up, everyone? You're listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. The purpose of this show is to share stories of hardship and victory as an encouragement for those in the middle of their own hard thing. Because we know hardship produces perseverance, which produces character, which ultimately produces hope. Today's guest is Mark Devine. Mark is a former Navy SEAL, the founder of SEALFIT, host of the Mark Devine podcast, and the best-selling author of Unbeatable Mind. Mark shares the story of founding Coronado Brewing Company and the fallout with his partners. He then discusses the power of your mind to shape your reality and the practices he applied to his own life in the midst of that difficult season. If you enjoy the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review so more people can be encouraged by the stories we share. Now here's the conversation with Mark Devine. Mark Devine on the Do Hard Things podcast. Mark, thanks for hopping on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, Dan. I appreciate you having me. Nice to meet
yeah.
you.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to give people a little context in case they've never heard of you before. And the question I like to ask is when people ask you what you do, how do you answer them?
I'm a teacher, but what do I teach? I teach mastery and service to humanity.
Okay.
And I have a number of different practices and methodologies and tools to kind of unfold or unlock what that means. Mastery is the process of continuously evolving yourself to your highest and best, you know, capabilities as a spiritual being having this human life. And service is like what you're going to do about it. Hmm. Aligning with your purpose, your calling, creating a mission, and then going out and making big impact in the world.
Yeah. That's a very specific answer, which I love. But how long did it take you to come to the
a while
the place?
Of course, yeah. I wasn't like born with this insight. Yeah, I grew up in a very small town, about 375 people in a pretty dysfunctional family. So, and I recognize now in retrospect, there was a reason for that because it made me pretty damn tough. Mm. And it gave me a lot of time for introspection. And it also, because I couldn't stand being under the roof of my house, I spent a shit ton of time out in nature, and I got into endurance sports and all these things, which prepared me to ultimately then shift focus to become an elite Navy SEAL, number one in my training class. I attribute that to my father's abuse and, you know, kind of our, you know, the forging of the character that came from that. And I really honor him for that. And I really thank him for that. And I also recognize that I chose that. But yeah, it wasn't until, so as a SEAL, you know, I was a warrior athlete, then a warrior leader. As I got more mature in my career, I recognized that I had this passion for training younger SEALs. And I wanted to teach them some of the things that I had learned, which included, you know, some of the things we talked about, like the forging of mental toughness through hard physical work, which you know a lot about, the refining of the mind through breath work and mantra and concentration training, which I learned through Zen and then obviously refined in the Navy SEALs and then later on through countless hours of martial arts training and yoga and teaching. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to teach SEALs, special operators, kind of these lost warrior arts. So I did that when I finally aligned that passion with my business. When I got off active duty, that business became SEALFIT. And I had a few fits and starts and entrepreneurial disasters kind of in between trying to figure all this out. But once I landed on that, it's been an incredible journey since. And that was 2006, like I said, and it really taught me that aligning with your calling and then bringing that out into the world is so crucial because then everything gets easy. So yeah, though I've had ups and downs with the business, you know, more things have absolutely lined up and exploded and felt easy for me than they did when I was not 100% aligned. Like when I launched the Coronado Brewing Company, a great, great business. I'm very proud of it, but it was a painful process. And I had, you know, disastrous fallout with my partners who are also my brothers-in-law and
Oh no.
It wasn't my purpose, right? And so there was a reason for all that happening. That's a long story. I just probably made it longer than you needed.
No way. That was good context, I think. The Navy SEALs, you know, they have a reputation, and I'm just curious, like, why did you decide to go into that? Because you went in later than most people would, right? You had a career 25. And left it.
I mentioned Zen. So when I graduated from Colgate University with an econ degree, fortunate enough to be picked up by Coopers and Lybrand, which is now PricewaterhouseCoopers. And they were participating in a program where they and other consulting firms, accounting consulting firms, were recruiting from liberal arts, you know, elite liberal arts colleges like Colgate, Williams, Amherst, Yale, Harvard. And they were recruiting not accounting graduates, but liberal arts graduates like myself. I had an economics degree. We had no accounting. And their idea was that they'd send us to NYU, Stern School of Business, get an MBA. And that over time, we would make, if we stuck around, we would make a more well-rounded partner, able to run a global business as opposed to just being an accountant. And honestly, it worked, because I'll tell you, my best friend from Colgate, Carmine DeCibio, was in the same program with me, but with a company called Ernst & Winnie, which became Ernst & Young. And now he's global CEO of Ernst & Young.
Oh, wow.
Or rebranded EY. EY. So, but most of us left and went in to make a lot of money or, you know, whatever. And so that was kind of my path. I was going to get my MBA and CPA and go off into maybe finance, and then eventually probably make my way back to the family business, which is in Utica, New York, and been around for over 100 years. But what happened, Dan, was when I went to New York, I was a really athletic, obviously athletic person for reasons that I described earlier. And I rode crew at Colgate and I swam competitively. When I got to New York, there was just something inside of me that said, I'm never going to not do hard work physically. Like, it's just part of my character.
Yeah.
There was, you know, it was rare for that, and certainly in the 1980s and even today, a lot of people, when they get in the professional workforce, they think they're too busy to take care of their body at that level, and then they lose it, right? And it's very hard to gain it back once you lose the consistency of the daily effort.
Yeah.
So I told myself at 21, I'm never going to not train every day. And so I was training in the morning, go for like a 6 mile run, and then I would do my, do a little stretching. And then at lunchtime, I would, you know, everyone else would go out. We had an hour. Everyone would go have a lunch, and I would go to the gym and bang out, you know, like a 20 minute wad, and then head back to the office, shower up. You know, I had 1 hour. So that was like an early version of a high intensity interval training before we knew what that was, right? And then they let us off of work at 5 o'clock because, you know, this is a participation with an NYU study program. So we had to get down to NYU Business School, which at that time was at the World Trade Center
before
9/11. Yeah. And so we had to be down at school at 7:30. And most people would go home, change, have some dinner, you know, prep for school. And I looked at that as another training block, right? So I was looking at it, said, what can I do in this time frame? I don't want to run again. I don't want to work out. I don't really have time to go do a sport like rowing or something. So one day I was walking home along 23rd Street, and I lived on 22nd Street, and I heard all these shouts coming out of the second floor building of this building. And I looked up, and I was standing under this sign that said World Sato Karate Headquarters. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's it. So I went up there. And I met the grandmaster who happened to have invented this style of karate or created it. He had several hundred thousand students worldwide back then. His name was Tadashi Nakamura. Well, so I started training, and I noticed within a couple months that on Thursday nights after his black belt class, I stayed one night to watch the black belt class. And then after that class, most black belts left. The lights went down, but a small group of students gathered in the corner, and they got these little wooden benches out. And they went into a meditation class with Nakamura. And they asked me to leave at that point. But I was like, wow, interesting. So I asked Mr. Nakamura if I could join that. I was really intrigued with that.
Yeah.
And I'd already started reading like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and, you know, martial arts type stuff, right? Warrior stuff. And I was intrigued with that meditation. So when I learned to meditate under his tutelage, it reminded me a lot of the, you know, when I would go on these like super long, like mountain runs, which, you know, you probably do all the time up in Washington, where you just go out and you just, your pace is just not normal, right?
Right.
Because you're literally like running up these mountains, and then I would run down. But at the top, when I, you know, you're exhausted, you have this expansive, beautiful view in this pristine environment. And I would drop into these incredible meditative states, these flow states, and have these great experiences. And so when I sat down to meditate, I was able to tap into those experiences again. And I was like, oh, this is legit, right? This is a way to get there without having to
climb the mountain.
Yeah. And especially in New York, I couldn't do that all the time. I lived in this jungle. So because I trusted Nakamura, because I had those early experiences, I decided to stick with it. And this is to get back to your original point. So I wasn't planning on being a Navy SEAL. In fact, my father, you know, he had kind of a go to jail or join the army moment. And so he joined the army for two years, 11th Airborne in Europe. He drove a car. He got drunk and drove his car into the fraternity house, and, you know, which that fraternity house didn't think was a great idea. And so they filed charges, and he's standing before a judge. And the judge literally said that. It's kind of like Elvis Presley. You either go to jail or you join the army. But my dad wasn't Elvis. You know, he was just this good looking kind of hellraiser. And so he had a horrible experience in the army, and he always associated with being a loser or you know, messing up. And so I wasn't thinking I was going to join the Navy, Army, anything. But sitting on that meditation bench and doing the introspective work has a profound impact on your brain. And so my brain got quieter and quieter, and I was able to begin to examine some of the stories that I was living my life by. And I recognized that they weren't my stories. I was living a path that was kind of laid out by my family, by their expectations, by society, by my school. But I kept on getting this feeling that I was going down the wrong path. And so I started to ask better questions. And that's when I also just quite naturally took up a journaling practice, because, you know, you got to write this stuff down.
Right. Get it out of there.
You got to get it out of your head. And so I started journaling, started asking different questions. That whole process took about 2 years before I literally had this epiphany that I am meant to be a warrior. And that's when the SEALs kind of revealed themselves to me.
Wow. Yeah, so that was a long time coming, it sounds like, a few years. And I mean, there's a lot of different ways you could go with that, right? Like you could be a warrior in a lot of ways.
You can be a warrior in a lot of ways. So it wasn't clear to me right away that I was meant to be a special operator or that I was going to join the SEALs. And you're absolutely right. In fact, I looked at different ways that I could be a warrior, to include going back and be a warrior with a family business, or staying and being a warrior as a partner. And I even looked at flying jets. I looked at working on an oil rig. You know, I called it trying on the uniform, you know, and I visualized myself doing all these different things. And while I was doing that, one day I was walking home. It's funny how things happen when you walk home from work in a state of contemplation. I walked past a Navy recruiting office, and they had a poster kind of facing out toward the street, and it said, "Be someone special." And it had images of Navy SEALs. It didn't say anything about the SEALs. It just said, "Be someone special." And, you know, there's a guy doing free fall parachuting. There's a sniper in a hide sight. And there's guys locking out of a submarine. And I'm like, oh, shit.
What yeah.
You know, that's what I want to do.
Wow. It's just a random walk one day. Well, it wasn't random, I guess. There were a lot of circumstances that led up to
it. That was synchronicity.
Yeah. You know? Wow. So I'm curious, when you made that transition, which for you, you know, it wasn't out of nowhere, but probably for a lot of people who knew you, it seemed like what just happened, right? What were those conversations like? What did people say? Were they encouraging you to pursue it? Or
my roommates were encouraging me, because I had a lot of conversations with them, and I lived with a couple of Yale graduates who were on, you know, in finance, and we had lots of conversations, and they knew who I was. They saw me constantly working out, constantly training, you know, and they also saw that I was like marking time as a CPA, getting my CPA and working. And I wasn't passionate about it. So when I started talking about the SEALs, they could immediately see that that was an awesome thing for me. My family, on the other hand, right? And anyone in my business, you know, in the professional side, were like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I didn't even reveal it to my family until I was certain that I was going to go in. I still hadn't gotten accepted. Right. That's a whole nother story. Like, it took me a long time to get accepted, because I wanted to be an officer and I was already a civilian. So most officers in the SEALs come from the Navy Academy.
Okay.
Or ROTC, meaning they're already commissioned. And then they
yeah.
take 20 a year that way, roughly. and they might take one or two out of the civilian force if they, you know, if they think they need some backup. They send those guys through Officer Candidate School. So that's the path I was going to take. So consider that one to, you know, I had statistically a very, very low chance of.
Yeah, I don't know how many the whole pool is, but one to two is not very many regardless.
It's not many, and it's significant, right? Thousands of guys want to be SEALs. So at any rate, I knew my parents would freak out, so I didn't tell them. At the same time, I still cared, you know, like we know, most of us do care, especially at a young age.
Yeah.
So when I did finally tell them I was going, they did freak out and they were not in support whatsoever. But by then I was determined and committed, and I was going regardless.
Yeah.
And when they, when I graduated as honor man in my class, number one graduate, and they came out for graduation, and they were, I could tell they were proud of me. And
that's cool.
Come around to the idea, so to speak.
Yeah. I was going to ask now how they felt, but it sounds like a long time ago, they felt a lot better about it.
Yeah. They're fine. You know, they still, you know, they shifted focus from that to trying to get me to come back to the family business, you know, for years. And then finally they gave up on that when they realized it's not going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Today, we'll just let him live his life.
They have no idea who I am. Like they're like, how did you become an author? Like, where do these books come from? And like, I just can't even explain to them, you know,
what's
happened to my mind with all the years and years of practice and training.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. Let's get into kind of the meat of this podcast and why it exists. And part of that, you know, is we want to be an encouragement for people in the middle of difficult seasons. We believe that the best way to do that is through people's stories of their own hard things, because it provides perspective for somebody. Like, I'm not alone in this. Someone else has been there. And it provides hope that like this too will end. Mm-hmm. And here's what came from it. It's not just what it feels like right now. The way we like to get at that is a singular question. And that's, what is the hardest thing in your life you wouldn't take back?
I wouldn't take anything back, although I would navigate things a little bit more skillfully. But I've come to see that everything happens exactly the way it's supposed to, and that there really is no hard thing with the shift in attitude. Things happen, and there's a lesson in everything. And so you may perceive it to be hard, or you could perceive it to be a rich and rewarding experience and an opportunity for growth and necessary for your growth in order to move to the next level or to shift out of something that is not right for you, especially when it comes to like a career change or, you know. And then you could say, well, what about ill health? And I suggest that ill health comes from patterns of living and thinking. And so it's an opportunity to look at the pattern of living and thinking, including, you know, epigenetically, and why, you know, patterns that, you know, your family for generations have lived and thought have led to this circumstance or this disease or, you know, this crisis to be in your life. So unwind all those patterns and you'll heal. You have to heal from a completely different level, though. You can't solve a problem from the same level that created it, but same thing, you can't heal from the same paradigm where the disease or thing was created. You have to do it from a different level. And the only way to do that is to go through the trial by fire of transforming yourself to be able to see from a new perspective and through new eyes. I've had businesses stolen from me. I had a $10 million government contract stolen from me by Blackwater. And they were, you know, there were some challenges with those experiences, but I quickly saw that they were really important to happen because I was going down the wrong path. Coronado Brewing Company got in this massive battle with my partners who are my brothers-in-law, and they haven't talked to me since, but they were unethical, and they were doing things that I didn't agree with that weren't in the interest of the shareholders. And so I was protecting the shareholders' interests, which then led them to try to break my wife and I up, ended up breaking their parents up because my father-in-law was a Marine, and he saw that I was doing the right thing, even if it wasn't in the interest of my partners, you know?
Yeah.
So that was, you know, at the time it seemed really painful, but at the same time, I wouldn't change it unless you could go back and choose different partners. But if I did, I might still be in the brewing business. I never would have created Seal
Right.
and, you know, done all the work that I've been doing here.
So it sounds a little bit like, speaking generally towards these difficult seasons, you're describing this shift from and I'll use this language, a victim of your circumstances to a creator of new circumstances, almost out of the ones that are present.
That's right. And also recognition that we create those circumstances that we think we're victims of. Our entire life is a creation of our mind, whether you're aware of it or not. And most people are unaware of it. So the practice for me, you know, self-awareness is all about coming to terms with this story that you've created, which is often fed to you, and you just quite unconsciously take it on. You get trained by culture if you don't train your own mind. So the first step is to recognize that and begin to unwind. You have to go through the process of negation first, then recognize that you're not that, and you're not that, and you're not that, and you're not that. And then you have to then fill in the blanks of, if not that, then what am I? So then that's the process of creation. So you go through deconstruction and negation, and then once you get to a tabula rasa or a ground zero, then you can create the new. Now, you can do this simultaneously, but what happens is oftentimes the old patterns counteract the new ones you're trying to create, right? This is why, that gets kind of confusing, because like you want something, and you're trying to practice positive self-talk and this and that, but there's a deeply rutted pattern of fear or negativity or some other belief system that's beneath it. That's why the emotional development and shadow work is so important to unwind all that. Anyway, so once you get to that point where you recognize that you are the creative force for everything in your life, including your body, then every day becomes an act of creation. And the more effective you get at this practice, the more spontaneous it becomes.
Okay.
And we call it, the Japanese have a term for that called shibumi, effortless perfection. It just spontaneously flows out of you. That's where my life has gotten in the last 5 years. It didn't take any effort whatsoever. At the same time, you know, I have plans and I have goals and vision, but I get more done through less action and allowing things to just flow.
Mm. So for all the people that are listening to this and they're like, well, that sounds really nice, but I have no idea how to get to that point. Like, how can I join you in saying that, you know, I can create in mentally everything that exists, you know, is coming from my mind, right? There's no outside forces acting on what is my reality. Cause it's like I said, it sounds like a nice idea,
but
that's not people's experience. Yeah, right. Or at least that's what they'd say.
To prove it to themselves. So I'm fully in concurrence with that. You have to be your own study of N=1. You have to be your own laboratory rat.
Yeah.
Don't trust what I say, but you practice it. So what does that look like? It means you spend time every day in contemplation, meditation, journaling, self-reflection, right? Mm-hmm. Socrates, who said that an unexamined life is not worth living. That's what he's talking about. Just blindly going through your life, just, you know, following the drumbeat of society and your family and whatever, accumulating wealth and credentials and all this. And then you get to, you know, later years and you're like, I'm still not happy. Okay. Mm-hmm. So maybe a new career or maybe a new girlfriend or wife, you know, and you have these midlife crises and you realize that's not it either. So start now to find out what is the true meaning of success. And it's self-awareness, which leads to great peace of mind and non-attachment to these things that we used to identify as ourselves, such as our career. Like, I don't identify myself as a Navy SEAL. That's just something I did. I'm proud of it. Mm-hmm. The SEALs are awesome, but it's just something I did.
Yeah.
I don't identify that as myself. So you go through that self-awareness practice every day, and then you just grow deeper and more clear in your self-identity as something vaster than any of those roles and accomplishments. And that vastness begins to be experienced as this massively creative individual. So it's just the daily practice. Now, that practice has two aspects to it. One is effort and the other is surrender. Now, in the Western world, we have this massive bias toward effort, toward action, toward growing, building, accomplishing. And we have not learned how to spend time in the surrender, which is to be just okay with things being the way they are, recognizing that everything is the way it is right now because it is the way it is, because you created it. Mm-hmm. So instead of always being agitated and not living in a present moment because you're not happy with things the way they are, learning to be okay with things the way they are, to be content and not to be attached to the goals and objectives and outcomes and accomplishments, just to be okay being who you are. That's the surrender. Doesn't mean you can't also work toward something better in service, you know, growth, but don't be attached to it. Surrender to everything, be just okay. You know, and the way this is expressed in kind of like therapeutic or emotional development work is the Western model is I've got to fix myself. So you're always striving to fix yourself. Endless therapy, endless trainings and, you know, course yep. and self-development. Whereas the Eastern model is just be okay with what is right now. Like Eckhart Tolle, be here now. The power of now, it's okay. Everything is the way it is because it is, because you created it. So be okay with it. But at the same time, it doesn't mean you can't, like I said, you can't also work toward a different future, but be okay with what's here now. So that effort and surrender go hand in hand or hand in glove. And this is represented in the Eastern yin yang symbol. Yang meaning effort and yin meaning surrender or acceptance. The masculine and the feminine principle. And most guys think, well, I don't want to be feminine, but you're missing the point there. It's not
right.
The feminine principle, which is acceptance. And the masculine principle is work or effort, right? And we're great at that. So men need to learn more of the acceptance and the surrender to the now and what is, and women need to learn to be more forceful. And those are really important to rebalance both our individual lives as well as our culture and society.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much that we could try to unpack there. And I think for sake of time, I'm going to let that kind of sit with people. But I want to go back to at least the story that you mentioned of, you know, your brothers-in-law and what you guys went through. Talk about how, you know, in the middle of the difficult season, you were able to see it as an opportunity in the midst of it. Because, you know, you're on the other side of it now and you can recognize it.
It's, of course, easier in retrospect.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say back then. So that was 1996 that I started that business. And I ran it through 2002 when I was able to basically sell my interest to my partners because they were just a nightmare to be with and I was trying to get away. At first, I collapsed into it, right? I was caught up in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then as I recognized that I was getting caught up into it and getting really emotional, I was like, I remembered that, wow, you know, I wasn't this way when I was on the meditation bench every day for the 4 years before I joined the SEALs. And even during the SEALs, when I had this intense like practice, but when I got off active duty and I started this business, like a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, we get swept up in the endless task management or task orientation and relentless pressure to raise money and to, you know, this and that.
Yeah,
I had gotten away from my practice for a while that for the first couple of years when all this was going on. So I said, screw it. You know, this is part of the problem. It's not just them. It's actually me. I'm collapsing into this thing and getting drawn up in the drama.
Yeah.
So I went back to my practice and journaling and meditation and I was able to get some space, some distance from it emotionally as well as kind of cognitively. And that's what allowed me to see that, you know, hey, I was just fighting this battle that I didn't need to fight because really this business wasn't the right business for me.
Yeah.
I'm happy that I started it. You got the entrepreneurial experience and the chops. You can probably earn, you know, 10 to 20X on your money by getting out of it now. Now it's a fraction of what it's worth today, but, you know, I could stay here and fight and drain a lot of emotional capital and real capital on legal fees and everything like that.
Yeah.
And then what's the end result is I'll be trapped in this freaking brewing business for the next 20 years, which is not my, and I wouldn't have had that insight had I not gone back to meditation and had the same kind of perspective. I'm like, oh, I'm barreling down the wrong path. Just like I was, you know, 10 years earlier, barreling down the path to be, you know, an accountant, you know, an accounting firm or back in the family business when I was really meant to be a warrior and a Navy SEAL and then be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And that reinforced in me to never get away from the personal practice again, right?
Because
that is critical for you to keep your perspective and to keep distance from the storms and the dramas in life.
Yeah.
You become, metaphorically, you become like a mountain. You're stable and the storms and dramas are like the clouds and the rain passing by. You see them, but you don't identify with that. You recognize that there's sun all the time on the other side of that cloud or the other side of that storm.
And so identify
with the sun.
Yeah, I would prefer to identify with the sun. Yeah. 365 days a year.
Easier for me down in San Diego when there is.
Yeah, that's true. It gets cloudy down there sometimes. You know, it's interesting, the two situations that you just talked about, right? When you were out of college, pursuing the career and a lot of financial opportunity and wealth potential. And then same thing with the brewing business, right? A lot of financial opportunity and wealth.
Both of them, I walked away from tens of millions of dollars.
And you know, like what you're saying is that was the wise and right choice, you know, in both situations. Right. And you didn't make the decision because there was more money on the other side. Like you made the decision for entirely different reasons.
There's great uncertainty on the other side. One was, what if I don't make it through SEAL training? You know, I'm stuck in the Navy.
Yeah.
And the other was, you know, if this business, walking away from this business that I poured all my IRA money in, I poured everything in, and, you know, I got a little bit out of it. It gave me enough to move up to North County, San Diego and buy a house, but I was back at ground zero. In fact, I ended up going back in active duty for a few years as a reservist to make ends meet. And I ended up going to NYU, or not NYU, but University of San Diego to get my doctorate in leadership. And I worked there as an adjunct professor. And I was doing all that until I got recalled to go to war in Iraq in 2004. And then when I was over there during war, I really doubled down on my practice every day.
Yeah.
And that's when I had another breakthrough epiphany that, you know, I didn't want to be an academic. So I left USD and I wanted to start a business doing what I actually really love to do, which was to train special operators on these warrior principles that I mentioned earlier. And that's when I started SEALFIT, when I got back from Iraq. I left USD, I left the PhD program, I left the adjunct professorship.
Yeah.
You know, and I started SEALFIT. And it's ironic because now 20 years later, I'm back in my PhD to kind of finish that.
That is ironic. but that's, I'm sure quitter. That's going to feel good.
I'm not a quitter. I was like,
no, you can't be. Yeah. So there's this shift in perspective. And another like theme that I'm noticing listening to you talk is in the almost like the downshift of your effort was where the purpose and realizations and awareness came from. And so many times I know in my own life and talking to other people, you know, it's how do I do more? How do I check off more things in my box to like figure out what those purposeful things are? Or I feel like this is my purpose. So I'm just going to like keep willing my way through it.
Right.
And to stop all of that effort feels
anytime
counterintuitive.
Anytime I tried that, I ran into a brick wall. So I learned that you had to do the opposite. You had to just stop all and go into complete monk mode.
Yeah.
And to reflect and to meditate and to contemplate and to ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the answers are always inside of you. They will be revealed to you, but you got to be quiet enough to listen. And that means you got to slow down. So my recommendation is that you develop this skill so that it happens in real time. You know, every day you kind of have this effort and then you surrender, meaning you take time in a morning ritual and an evening ritual to reflect and ask questions. How'd it go? Am I on track? Is this still my purpose? So you do this refinement in real time, as opposed to like wait until you hit a wall or the crisis comes or the disease shows up, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. Why do the healthy thing only when it's like,
that's right,
demanded of you.
Having said that, it's effective, right? You get a disease like cancer and you're forced to stop and reflect on your life and change your habits and your beliefs and behaviors. And some people think that's the best thing to happen, but it's a painful way to go.
Yeah.
When you could literally just start a self-awareness practice and using skillful means of first de-stressing your body with breathing practice and then learning how to concentrate your mind and develop mental power and then developing metacognition and mindful awareness so that you can begin to think about your thinking and make better choices. And then from there, you develop the ability to just touch base with that inner sight, the insight, so that you have these answers at your disposal when you ask.
So in that difficult season, you know, it sounds like you came to the point where you realized you needed to slow down, but were there people around you who were also like, was there people giving you good advice in the process?
No, this happened all through just my own self-discovery. Again, I'm very grateful for Nakamura and the Zen practice that I had, because once you start a practice like that, you plant seeds that sometimes take years to grow. And so those seeds were planted by Nakamura, and I kept coming back to my practice. And the seals I practice in a different way, because, you know, it's kind of like wax on, wax off. You're standing on a parachute, you know, jump on the ramp of a C-130, you're practicing. Like, I was box breathing, I was mindfully aware, I was managing my emotions, I was concentrating on my discrete tasks of, you know, jumping out of this airplane and not killing myself. So my practice became real time during the SEALs. I didn't really have time to sit on a bench. And I learned that that's the ultimate practice, is when you get off the bench and you bring it into your daily life, and every moment is a wax on, wax off moment where you're in, you're in awareness of why you're doing things and what's happening, and you're not caught up in the drama and swept up in it. So I developed that in the SEALs even more, and then have continued to refine that through the years. So that's been extremely valuable for me.
Yeah, the active, there's an analogy there as well of, you know, you can look at a map, right? And kind of memorize the way you're supposed to go, and then set off on your journey.
Right.
Or you can like bring the map with you and have the reference points as you go. And it's, right. it's going to be way more effective.
Right. And it's more effective if you set 20 waypoints on your path, and every waypoint you just pause and you ask, am I going in the right direction?
Yeah.
And you just take some time to recover. It's like the, you know, the tortoise versus the hare, as opposed to just be like, that's where I want to go. And you, you know, set off and you don't ever check your direction. And if you're 1 degree off, you know, of course you've heard that metaphor, then you end up like 1,000 miles off from your destination.
Right. Yeah. So flipping that advice question around, I mean, you've kind of been doing this, but I'm just going to ask it directly. For somebody who's in the middle of a hard season right now, what advice would you give them?
Okay. So I would say, great opportunity, right? It's an opportunity. Yeah. And guess what? There'll be more, right? Life is never, you know, just ice cream and candy. In fact, if it were, then that would become the hard thing, right? Yep. So recognize that we just go through these waves, you know, sometimes things are great, sometimes things don't feel great. So learn to not be attached to when things are great, and learn to not be attached to when things aren't so great. Just recognize that it is part of life, and that there's lessons to be learned when things don't feel like they're going well. And there's just as like there's lessons to be learned when things are going well, because then you get complacent, or then you think you've made it, and guess what? Life will be there to smack you down, and then you go through the next cycle of hard. So just to recognize it, that's normal, and this too shall pass. The rain clouds will pass, but it's not who you are.
Yeah.
Don't identify with this struggle and say, oh, I'm all screwed up, or I'm a jerk, or I did something really bad. Just say, oh, this is happening. It's happening for a reason. What can I learn from this? But it's not who I am.
Yeah.
I am a really good person deep down. I am infinitely creative and awesome person. And this is just something that's happening in life, and it'll pass. And then when it passes and things are starting to get really good, you still do the same practice. Like, okay, this is awesome, but this is not who I am.
Right.
Don't think all of a sudden you're the rock star and this is all because of you and you're the superstar. Because if you do, the universe will smack you down. So this is a practice of non-attachment. Don't be attached to the highs or the lows, and you develop this stability, this equanimity, this continuous flow of just being okay with what is. And then as you develop that, then what happens is those highs and lows smooth out, because you are resonating at this super balanced flow state, okay with what is up or down. Then those ups and down, those swings start to really, really smooth out until they're like just tiny little waves.
Yeah.
And then we call that flow, life flow, or optimized performance. Peak performance is you struggle and then you peak and then you crash, and people go through these wild swings. Optimized performance is like, I'm ready for anything. And and if I got a peak to climb Mount Rainier, I just tweak my training program. I get ready for it. I go climb Rainier. I come back and I don't go through this, you know,
right.
wild like downturn of post-mountain partum depression, you know,
or something like that. Post-mountain. That's probably a real thing.
I just made it up, but yeah. Any mountain climber probably knows what I'm talking about.
I have a few mountain climber friends, and I have witnessed that in them. I think you might have coined something real. So to tie around what you're saying a little bit, this idea of, you know, steady state or these things don't define me. And it sounds, you know, it's all very much internalized and individual, and you're in control of those things. But, you know, there's this element of, you know, you're not alone. Like, you live with people around you, and you have other voices that are coming at you to say one thing or another. And so how do you maintain some sense of that purpose and direction when there's a lot of other voices coming at you and noise?
This is also part of the practice, that you have to prove to yourself that what I'm saying is accurate or is true. When you are identified with the roles and the things that happen, then everyone else seems to have this impact on you. Like, people are coming at you. They're throwing things at you, and and you feel like you're buffeted around by other people.
Mm-hmm.
When you shift your awareness and you recognize that you are the creator of your mind, and your mind is the creator of your life, and then you begin to live from that, then people respond to you very differently. Because what really is happening is you're projecting all your fears and all your weaknesses and all your things that you don't like in other people. You're projecting them out there, and so they're giving it back to you. And you mistake that as someone doing something to you. And when you become more evolved than the way we're talking, where you develop this separation between your thoughts and emotions and who you know yourself to be, and you live from that place of equanimity, then you stop projecting all these fears onto other people, and then they stop giving it back to you. And suddenly you recognize that, wow, I really do create this life, and my mind can actually impact how people react to me or come at me or do or do not. And mm-hmm. you make much better decisions about who to allow into your life, what you allow them to do, and how you allow them to interact. And this is called boundaries. Also saying no to things that you shouldn't be doing, and commitments, as opposed to being codependent. You know, there's a lot of ways you can then analyze what I'm saying from an emotional or therapeutic perspective, but it's all quite natural from a spiritual perspective. When you live from that higher sense of self, you don't allow other people to disrupt the calm, you know, epicenter of your mind. I call that the still water that runs deep. You know, all that stuff is just surface chop, but you live at that depth.
I love all the geographic analogies too. We're in the ocean, way down there at the mountain peaks.
Well, these are experiences that are hard to describe, and so metaphors are really useful.
I appreciate them. And I think, you know, most people do. We all can relate to some degree and understand the power of those things too. Like, those are substantial, significant things. All right, last question for you. What is a hard thing that you're in the middle of right now?
Going back to get my PhD at 58, you know, required some re-engineering of my mind, especially, you know, I've authored like 5-6 books now, and I get to just say what's on my mind and what I've learned in my life. You can't do that in a PhD program. They don't care what you think. They want to know what other people think, and then where the gap in the knowledge is and what you're going to do about that gap. So opinion has no place in it. So I literally have had to like retool how I think, and it's very good for me, but it's been challenging.
Yeah. So how much do you have left?
I just started. I'm in my third semester. I got I got 4.5 years ahead of me.
Oh man. But,
you know, people say, why do you do this? And I don't need it. You know what I mean? I don't need my doctorate, but I mentioned earlier, I started it and didn't finish. So there was that. And then also, I'm trying to, with my business Unbeatable, we do like serious leadership development, peer group leadership development, but a lot of people still perceive it to be like Mark Divine's Unbeatable Mind. I used to even call it my podcast that, and my personality is still really wrapped up in it. And still have people coming thinking they're going to get trained by this Navy SEAL. And I want to study the efficacy of this integrated 5-mountain development program that we've developed and how it works. I realized that I could hire someone to do that, but I wanted to do it myself and to bring credibility to the program so I can really expand it into the corporate arena where, you know, people don't trust you or believe you unless you've got a bevy of doctors and PhDs.
Right.
You know,
all of the things on your wall that say that you've read a lot of books.
And the last reason is, you know, back to this idea, I don't ever want to be complacent, right? So I'm studying Aikido now, and that's been the hardest martial art I've ever studied. I've already got 3 black belts. Why do I need it? I don't, except I want to continue to grow and learn and challenge myself. So I've had to like unlearn most of what I learned in my, you know, kick-ass jitsu to learn Aikido, which is the art of peace, or the art of blending with the other person's energy so you do no harm, you know?
Yeah.
It fits my personality now, and so, but I'm doing it to grow and to evolve and to challenge myself. Same thing with the doctorate. God bless my wife for being okay with my
coach. I was going to ask you, like, how's your wife handle all of these things?
She's cool with it. I told her, don't let me quit this PhD because I'm always bitching about how much work it is.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah, she's got to encourage you and keep your feet to the fire a little bit, probably sometimes. Wow. Well, for people who, you know, were something was sparked in them listening to this, or they're just interested in learning more, how can they keep up with you or follow you, learn some more about what you do and everything you're working on?
Okay. There's a couple of ways. So first, since you are dealing with people who, you know, are in great transition or change, one of the best ways to really break through to new ideas, new insights, new perspective is to really challenge yourself. Mm. And that's what we do at SealFit, my company SealFit. Go to sealfit.com or also unbeatablemind.com, because we run the SealFit programs through my company, Unbeatable.
Okay.
We have these crucible events, which are like 6, 12, 24, and 50 hours of really intense training based upon or modeled upon Hell Week, the Navy SEALs Hell Week. And they're extraordinary experiences. With Unbeatable, we have a great community and also this peer group program, coached program we call Boat Cruise, which is an extraordinary year-long, multi-year-long program on vertical development, we are working with you to evolve your consciousness to the next stage and then beyond. And then if you just want to learn more about me and my the books that I've written and my podcast, The Mark Divine Show, you can find all that information at markdivine.com, also my newsletter to subscribe. And social media channels, all this stuff is linked at markdivine.com.
Great. I didn't know about those crucible events.
They're amazing experiences. That's where it all started, Dan. I mean, I ran these back in 2006. I would run these 30-day immersive, like live-in warrior monk academies for spec ops guys, ladies, but most of them were guys, obviously. And so these 30-day academies, I would have these students come live with me at my training center in Encinitas. And we train from 0 dark 30 in the morning until like 10, 11 at night. And then the graduation ceremony after 30 days was this nonstop 50-hour event that we now call Kokoro, which means merge your heart and mind into your actions. Well, over the time, I couldn't sustain. In fact, what happened is those 30-day academies broke into 3 different programs, Unbeatable Mind, SealFit, and also Kokoro Yoga.
Yeah.
And 3 best-selling books came out of that because I was doing so much new creative content and developing so many new innovative programs. They ultimately defined themselves and separated into separate programs. And SealFit, we still run the online training and preparation for those crucibles. And we still run that 50-hour event. And because a lot of people said they just couldn't handle it, we ended up creating preparatory events.
So the 50-hour is the goal.
50, yeah, you don't really want to just jump into the 50-hour unless you're an elite athlete. And even if you are, it's beneficial to do either the 12 or the 24-hour so that you can learn where your gaps are, train properly for the 50. And so you can actually, in the 50-hour, like I said, it's a physical, mental, emotional, intuitional, and spiritual experience. You don't want to just gut through it as an athlete or a spec ops guy. We have a lot of people who try to that, and they do. But you learn more if you really, really come in radically prepared, because you become a good teammate and you're in service to your other teammates. And that's really the main outcome there, is you get out of your sense of individuality, or I've got this, or I'm the tough one. And you realize, and we set it up, that you can't possibly do everything alone.
Yeah.
You have to be a good teammate. And there's times where you have to ask for help, force you to do that.
And so
it's an extraordinary experience. You would love it, Dan. If you want to do it, let me know.
I'm listening to you describe it, and it's like right up my alley. You know, it sounds terrible and awesome at the same
terribly
time.
Terribly awesome. So. That's the way we describe it. It's terribly awesome. Oh,
perfect. Well, you described it accurately then. Well, Mark, I really appreciate you spending some time with us and sharing your wisdom that's been gained through a lot of experience and difficult seasons. And yeah, thank you for being here.
It's been my honor. Thank you, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Do Hard Things podcast by Elite SRS. We hope you're encouraged today and have a newfound hope to persevere. Be sure to subscribe for more great episodes and conversations. And if you ever want to watch an episode, check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/ElitesRS. Have a blessed day.